Welcome to the Mandalorian podcast by Fantastic Geek, your official, unofficial podcast for the Outer Rim. My name is Matt, and joining me in the co-pilot seat is Pete. Hello, Pete.
What up, all my Mandos and Mandettes? The Mandalorian podcast by Fantastic Geek dons our helmets for Chapter 1.
Pete, donning it indeed on this, the launch day of the show and launch day of Disney Plus. We finally made it. The counter finally got to zero. And at 6 a.m., if not earlier, depending on what device and location you were watching on, you had access to the bounty of goods. And Pete, just like the opening of Disneyland, no problems, right?
Well, no problems for me. I was a little bit more fortunate than most. I had already seen about a half hour of footage prior to the release, but since the pilot itself in toto was embargoed from press, this was pretty much a virginal experience for everybody. I got that in. I finished up at about 6:15, 6:20 this morning Eastern time. And then it hit the fan, apparently.
Yeah, I think for much of the morning, logging in was an issue, or you get there and clicking on stuff was an issue. It just looked like total meltdown, which I guess I understand. I mean, they chose a time, 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific, that you would wake up to open your Disney Plus present, as opposed to the Netflix model of 3 a.m. Eastern, and more than half of the, I think three quarters of the United States population lives in the two Eastern time zones. And then midnight Pacific, which is to say, on the West Coast, you can stay up. On the East Coast, you're probably asleep unless you're a diehard. I think maybe they got rolled by 6 a.m. Everybody's getting up to check it. Now 7 a.m. and 8 a.m. and 9 a.m. as the entire continent wakes up, let alone our friends in Canada, etc. I mean, while Pete, everyone in the Netherlands, it's, you know, late morning and they're having a jolly time before the troubles hit. But, you know, fast forward to this evening, to this afternoon, and everything looks okay.
I tried to watch it again mid-morning a little later. I was getting the error message that everybody on social media was reporting. Watched it a third time this afternoon without incident. What was your experience, Matt?
About the same thing. I had about a little bit less than half an hour watched, by 6:30 in the morning or so. And then hadn't really tried to watch as the day went on, but certainly tried to hop on and found myself unable. I feel like early afternoon, I was just clicking around on the app. Getting on there was okay. And then it's like, oh, let me click on Avatar just because it popped up. Oh, Avatar is starting. Okay, I guess everything's working now. And then rewatching the whole episode, including the ending, or seeing the ending for the first time this evening, it was a-okay.
Well, Matt, this being launch day, this being our inaugural Chapter 1 episodic review, we're going to take you through that, but not without a preview of what to expect from us the rest of the week. First, on the Mandalorian feed.
Yeah, so obviously cranking out this podcast for Episode 101, a.k.a. Chapter 1. Same day, we will settle into, for the rest of the Mandalorian run this season, we'll settle into Star Wars Saturdays, the show dropping most of the run on Fridays, the one exception being on Wednesday, December 18th, which is the Wednesday before the Thursday and the Friday of Star Wars Rise of Skywalker. It'll drop on a Wednesday. We still are going to podcast on the Saturdays. So really, really looking forward to the discussion with you, Pete, as well as the discussion with our listeners.
This on top of even busier doings at Fantastic Geek headquarters here, not only bringing you two episodes of The Mandalorian this week, tomorrow, Watchmen Wednesday, episode 104 of Watchmen, before bringing you Star Trek Short Trek on Thursday, and then we get our Mandalorian up on Disney Plus. But Matt, do you check your chronometer there? I think it might be time for something.
It's time to hit the hunt.
the teaser, a tracking fob beeps on an icy landscape as our titular character tracks his quarry. Inside a warmer watering hole, a blue-skinned mithril's head is tossed upon a table as his glands are particularly prized to sell at the port.
This, using all the tropes of a Western right off the bat, I mean, the Mandalorian, is walking on a wooden boardwalk, albeit one covered by, you know, dust and snow and whatnot. Pete, the guy who I'm calling Beardo, is upset that his drink is spilled, and trying to pin it on the Mandalorian. Hey, Mando, you spilled my drink. Oh, is that really Beskar steel? Pete, they're setting up exposition stuff for later, and it doesn't even feel like it. It just feels like a space bar fight. The bartender pours a new drink, trying to prevent that fight from happening. The only thing missing, Pete, somebody playing on an old-timey piano. But it's Mandalorian who takes out the crew. Pete, bloodless. Welcome to Disney Plus, where people die but don't bleed. Indeed, Pete, Squidface gets chopped in half by the circular door, but bloodless, Pete, bloodless.
Yes, the Quarren alien there, he attempts to run. Love that he takes a shot. The Mandalorian doesn't shoot him, shoots the door, and severs him in half. The previously imperiled Mithril thanks the Mandalorian, offering him his credits for a drink, before he produces a hologram of him on a bounty puck.
And may I point out, Pete, that here we see the thing that we mention all the time, particularly in series openers on our podcasts. We see this effortless exposition. It'll be verbal in a little bit, but what have we learned so far, in addition to, you know, the Western aesthetic and, you know, the bounty hunter aesthetic? Beskar steel has been name-checked, the fact that he wears it, he gets shot by a blaster and it bounces off, all of this doing kind of, you know, story duty to have us understand the world that we're in, or at least the particular slice that we're inhabiting here. But as you mentioned, there is the bounty puck there. Mithril is saying, oh, there must have been a mistake. Oh, I have more credits. But he is told that he can be brought in warm or cold with the shot of the old... The cloak moved out of the way, the blaster on the hip, and Pete, something tells me he's going to choose warm as we hit the title card.
Back outside in the icy landscape, the Mandalorian tells a long-snouted Kabuzian ferryman he needs passage to the yards. The ferryman blows a flute, and the droid-driven land speeder pulls up, but the Mandalorian doesn't do droids.
So a second speeder gets brought up. It is sputtering and falling apart. It's got four engines, Pete, but it did remind me of an earlier model, you know, what, about 5-8 years ago. You'd see them, you know, barely fetching you any money in places like Tatooine. But they go across the ice as the driver watches out for Ravenax. They do love being near where the gray holds have been dumped. Pete, second viewing, I realized, wait, gray holds, gray water. he's talking about, you know, this is Star Wars space language for, you know, Pete, like Cousin Eddie used to say, I'll paraphrase, emptying out the toilet area of your mobile space home.
Yes, and comedian Brian Posehn is exactly the choice to deliver this type of Star Wars literal bathroom humor.
The Mandalorian and Mithril get dropped off at his ship. The Mandalorian and the driver settle up, and the driver suggests that they stay off the ice. Pete, that's the second warning there. The third, I dare say, will not go as well. Mithril watches as the speeder, you know, gets, I don't know, 50, 100 feet away, maybe even space meters, I don't know. But ultimately, the speeder gets pulled down by what we can assume is a Ravenak. Our hero and Bounty jump into the ship. Pete, we get a Star Wars swear. Dank Farkas. That was fast.
Yes, and as they attempt to leave, the Ravenak has latched on to the landing gear. The Mandalorian grabs the classic rifle mat, you know, all the way back to the Star Wars special, the introduction of Boba Fett with that two-pronged rifle, uses it to shock the monster there, and they're able to get clear.
All we need is one more reference to that special, Pete, and then we will know Jon Favreau's secret desire to canonize that. But indeed, the ship ultimately is able to take off in triumphant fashion. I suppose, Pete, there's some sort of computer-aided takeoff there, since the Mandalorian is still kind of coming in from the port. But ultimately, Pete, here's where we get effortless exposition, and it really does not feel like the show trying to introduce stuff. Why? Because Mithril needs introducing to this situation too. He likes the ship, Mithril does. It's Razor Crest, pre-Empire. Is it true you guys never take off your helmets? Can I ask more exposition questions? Nope. Pete, time to hit the vac tube.
Yes, looking for the space bathroom. Promises he won't go anywhere. I love the detail. I love that we're even referencing space toilets. Okay. In our Western set in space, that, you know, you got to go, you got to go. And all these different attachments below decks. But not only does he find the vac tube, he finds a weapons cache in a closet, which he closes, along with three carbonite-encased bounties, whom he joins when the Mandalorian finds him snooping around.
But Pete, not before he mumbles to himself slash up to the control area there that he hoped he'd be home for life day, maybe get back to the family there. Pete, that's the second incantation of the Star Wars holiday special.
Yes, wait until episode 6 when digital Art Carney shows up.
Pete, if we don't have B. Arthur singing in 4K in this show by the end of it, by the end of the season, I think it will have been a missed opportunity. Fast forward time-wise a little bit, Mandalorian flying to a new planet, a new town, steps into a new bar, this one cosmopolitan and crowded, at least a bit more cosmopolitan. Pete, some reviewers complaining that there wasn't enough alien flavor. You look at this scene, there's aliens aplenty, without trying to outdo the cantina scene, I might add, or, you know, Maz's watering hole, which itself was lovingly trying to outdo or redo. He gets noticed as he arrives, by the way, and ultimately sits down with Greef Karga, a fantastic character name. Pete, in the world of Star Wars, they usually name characters pretty easily evocatively. I think Greef Karga has anger and grief.
Yes, the head of the Bounty Hunters Guild here, who orders the offloading of the cargo for Karga. And he's paying Imperial credits, but the Mando not accepting. Haven't you heard? The Empire's gone. Matt, when does this series take place, right? This is after The Rise of Skywalker and before The Clone Wars and, you know, sometime in between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi and also way down the line, right? When is this made abundantly clear for us this is taking place?
Where's my Count Dooku prequel? Yeah, Pete, it was interesting in the last night in the countdown to this show, people were making comments like, on social media, like, I just wish they'd tell us whether it's all the episodes at once or not. What's the release schedule? I'm like, okay. I replied, I'm like, Tuesday, then Fridays. Oh, Tuesday, then one a week. I didn't want to get into the whole Wednesday thing for later in December. But it's like, no, they've been out there. Was there like an official Disney press release? I don't know. Pete, here's what they did for this show, and for the service, for that matter. They kind of slow-walked everything so that you had to go dig it, so that you had to go up in the attic yourself to look for presents, not just automatically assume, I'm gonna get exactly what I want. Maybe that was done to temper expectations. Maybe that was done as a slick marketing move. I think it's more the latter, on the heels of the whole D23 can't miss deal that was available to everybody after a couple of clicks. But everything is okay. Pete, we have Star Wars, the TV show. The only person who's upset about it is the Mandalorian, who got paid in calamari flan and only got paid half.
Love the squishy sound effect of the calamari money. Only got half, but that's fine. The jobs that are around still, though, are mostly bail jumpers with an occasional smuggler thrown in. The Mandalorian will take them all, but whoa, 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 says Greef Karga. He's got to save some for the other members of the guild. But as slow as it might seem, it's actually busy. We just have people that don't want to pay the guild rates. Isn't that always a story? They don't mind if it gets a little sloppy. Highest bounty? Only being 5,000, that won't even cover fuel, Matt.
Seemingly backed into a story corner, Greef Karga, I mean, he's not backed into a corner. He has backed the Mandalorian into a corner. There is one job, though. No Puck. It's a direct commission. Is it Underworld? Sorry, Rick McCallum. We don't get an answer on that one. But the Mandalorian is handed a chit to go get that face-to-face meeting. And he takes it. He walks the next location. We see more of the quiet streets of this quiet town. And
we see Jawas not on Tatooine, something that had never been glimpsed before.
Pete, it's a big, wide, interesting series of worlds out there. He does make his way to a nondescript door, though. Knock, knock. One of those droid eyes a la Jabba's palace comes out, checks the chit. And lets him in. He's got a short hallway, then steps into an office where, iconic from the footage that we've already seen, the previews and whatnot, four ragged stormtroopers are there.
Yes, along with Werner Herzog's client character wearing Imperial gear, and says that he expected him from Karga, knows that he's the best in the parsec. A door opens at an inopportune time, and Dr. Pershing enters, creating a sudden standoff.
Yes, where the Mandalorian has pulled out his gun, fearing attack from Dr. Pershing. The stormtroopers pulling out their guns, and the client, as you said, Pete, played by Werner Herzog, who... has said in the press that he did not have expectations as to working with Jon Favreau because he was unfamiliar with Jon Favreau's work, you know. Which, Pete, I'll just admit it, that hurt me a little bit, okay? Reflecting on Jon Favreau in the last week, seeing him on The Chef Show, talking about writing that new show with Dave Filoni while they do an episode of Chef Show up at the Skywalker Ranch, realizing all of this, flashing back to my high school days where Favreau was there in Swingers, realizing time marches on for all of us, realizing my hairline has done better than that of Jon Favreau. At least I have that, you know, though I have not directed two $1 billion movies. And to realize Werner Herzog just like has never experienced the joy of Swingers. Alas, maybe that's why he looks so mournful as the client.
Yes, but he gets his stormtroopers to lower their blasters. The Mandalorian sits, and he produces from a cloth some Beskar steel bearing an Imperial stamp. But that's only a down payment. He has a Cam Tono, however much that is.
Pete, a whole Cam Tono? Is that really? Wow. We don't need to explain to anybody how much a Cam Tono is.
It's good. Okay. Upon delivery of the asset. Alive.
Yes, alive indeed. He, the client, adds that proof of termination at a lower fee is acceptable. Dr. Pershing says that was not part of the plan, the understanding, etc. And ultimately, all that gets handed to the Mandalorian are bits and pieces that he can use. He's given a tracking fob, which we've seen in action. I think it really only is fully clear by the end of the episode that the tracking fob somehow works, you know, kind of ultra short range or fairly short range. He's also given the last four digits of the code, which is their age. Whew, Pete, they are 50. Did you notice their use of a gender-neutral pronoun there twice? Because that keeps the mystery mysterious.
And as well as the last reported positional data, a man of the Mandalorian skills, Matt, should make short work of this. Oh, and hey, as you're leaving, isn't it good that the Beskar is back in the hands of a Mandalorian? Feels good to restore the natural order of things after a period of such disarray, right? When the empire was toppled 5 years ago. Everybody clear on that?
Pete, I am not quite clear what sort of metaphor they're going for, having an older German man talk about wanting to have the natural order of things. It escapes me. Perhaps it will be revealed in future
given
episodes.
That this planet is not named the same way the ice world was not named, the same way the next planet is not named, which I kind of dig. Instead of getting cards and, you know, the idea that we are on other Tatooine or what have you. I think I know the name of this planet, even though we're never told. It's clearly Argentina.
Oh, I get it, Pete, because that's where the Nazis escaped to. I don't think you are suggesting it as a complete yuck-yuck joke, nor am I receiving it as such. I do like the idea that he's, you know, former empire on the run to this place that kind of isn't going to make a big deal of it. Ultimately, the Mandalorian, of course, takes the job. He takes the slab of Beskar steel and walks the streets again, filled with colorful creatures and people. We also have
monkey lizards on a rotisserie.
Yes. He ultimately steps into a stairway. There's other Mandalorians about, including helmeted children. He ends up at a room, appears to be half forge, half sanctuary, nods to the woman, and gives her the money and the calamari flan.
The Beskar and the calamari flan. But this female armorer, she has very conspicuously horns on her helmet. Those that watched the Clone Wars might remember that there were several Mandalorian clans that pledged fealty to Darth Maul that changed their helmets in such a way.
Ooh, good catch there, Pete. She looks at the steel and says that it was gathered in the Great Purge. Definite, and you know, no joke here, definite echoes of kind of, you know, gold stolen by the Nazis and melted down and getting the whole stamp on it and things like that. She asks, because people are ready for a little bit more exposition here. We're going slow here, in a good way. We're not jamming the entire backstory and whatnot down here. She asks if his signet has been revealed. He says not yet. She opens her tools, definitely the old school tools of a metalworker. She's reforming the steel. She says that the excess will sponsor many foundlings, and he was one once. And we get flashbacks to presumably his childhood, being on the run, chaos everywhere, separated from his mother, etc. And Pete, what does the metal get turned into in the present day?
Into a pauldron there for his right shoulder. I gotta wonder, and we'll talk about this when we get into our segment where we discuss theories, is this going to be the motif chasing down the Beskar, reforging the armor? You look at enough of the advertising, there's clearly other pieces that emerge as the series go on.
Certainly would be an effective way to have a story clock of sorts. I mean, we haven't had him say, I wish I had the whole suit. I am 8 pieces away. Now I'm 7. But it would be a way to kind of certainly show the passage of time. With that, we cut to his ship flying to a desert planet, not unlike Vasquez Rocks, which is within the 30-mile zone of Los Angeles, and things like that. Also filmed from certain angles, looks like exactly where Kirk battled the Gorn and where Michelle Hurd's character hangs out in a trailer in Star Trek Picard. So, Pete, many pointy rocks in many Stars, Treks, and Wars. He's scoping out the scene. A giant creature, ultimately referred to as a Blurg, overtakes him. He tries to fight it off. Pete, I like that he appears to be losing the battle against the Blurg, for it is felled by a taser dart.
Yeah, his flamethrower just not quick enough. And then Nick Nolte, Ugnaught character, emerges here and will help the bounty hunter.
And, I mean, what a great character. I was trying to figure out the entire time, is it Nick Nolte in a prosthetic with some, you know, like remote control electronics there for the chin. The character looks a little slight. Probably not going to have Nick Nolte put on that amount of makeup. So you have a smaller actor, and it has somewhat of that slight remote controlled snout jankiness that I think is very Star Wars in its aesthetic, which I hadn't stopped to consider until this scene, that there's a slight aged quality to Star Wars that if you want to hit, it can't all be perfect computer graphics all the time with everything. But Pete, great character here. Am I correct in saying that in this episode, you know, my notes call him Nick Nolte because I was waiting for him to say, "You can call me Scrog Grog," but he never gets a name, right?
He doesn't. You have to imagine, since the episode remains on this world, you got to hope you don't just get Nick Nolte for, you know, essentially three scenes in one episode, three short scenes at that. So I imagine, I mean, the character's name is out there. We at Fantastic Geek like to refer to the names as they appear. I didn't scan the credits for his name. You can surely do that as well.
All I know is this, Pete. I'm totally looking forward to the Mandalorian, IG-11, and a whole bunch of other people banding together and having a good old time as a group of guys and friends. And yeah, no way they'd have a major actor, voice, director, whatever it might be, come in and just do a scene or two. Otherwise, we'd be completely shocked. But bottom line is, this character, he will help the Mandalorian. He has spoken.
Inside Nick Nolte Ugnaught's home, it's revealed here that many have passed through seeking the same target here. Nick Nolte Ugnaught helped them each time, but they died. The Mandalorian's not sure he wants his help. But he'll show him to the encampment, and he'll do it for half, Matt, half a blurg.
Either half a blurg or half the blurg total. I dare say, Nick Nolte Ugnaught, maybe there's less use in half a blurg. I just want to point out the simple iconography here. They're at a ranch. Yes, it's a space ranch with blurgs and with an Ugnaught, but we get the wide exterior shot. There's the wind-driven water pump thing that, you know, you see in many a, certainly still modern, many an old-timey Western and whatnot. And it just, the fact that this is a Western in space, not kind of like space, opera, Western, adjective, it's really hammered home in this scene as so many others. And we then, Pete, get not exactly a montage, but it's time for the Mandalorian to learn how to ride a blurg. It's difficult. Mando is ready to give up, but he's reminded that ancestor Mandalorians rode the great Mythosaurus. Surely he can ride a foal. I mean, this is just great Star Wars dialogue here. It sounds familiar. The made-up words sound familiar, but still kind of foreign and far, far away.
You know, he wants a land speeder or a speeder bike, but we're told it's impossible to reach the encampment without a blurg mount. And this is a female that he tried to roast. Maybe that's why it's tossing him, but the males get eaten during mating. Love the transition after he's finally wrangled it on the dried up type of lakescape. As they're going there, those massive dried out patches, mercenaries have come through there. Anybody who's settled, we're told, has looked to live in peace. Why is he helping the Mandalorian, though? Nick Nolte Ugnaught has never met one, and he's only read the stories. If they're true, he should make quick work, and then there will be peace as he pieces out.
I think my only complaint about this episode comes from this scene, and I guess it's twofold. I felt like we did not spend enough time with Nick Nolte Ugnaught, and if that's because we are headed back there in Chapter 2, then I kind of preemptively withdraw the concern. But second is, I feel like we didn't see terrain that a speeder couldn't handle. We kind of needed some more, like, vertical steps type stuff. Pete, I know you're not a Lord of the Rings guy. I think there's like the Black Steps or something like that. Something that really where it's like, oh, that is suited for blurgs, as opposed to, let me crank up my speeder up to like 90 and I can get through those little cracks here and there. But Pete, if that's the complaint of this episode, I will take it, because this is a fun time at the TV show.
But just as he's arrived to where he needs to conduct the business, a bounty droid, IG-11, not to be confused with IG-88 of The Empire Strikes Back, announces subparagraph 16 of the Bondsman Guild Protocol waiver compelling the assets captors to immediately produce said asset, and a firefight ensues. There's a lockdown. Droids. Am I right, Matt?
Droids indeed. I feel like with IG-11, they hit the sweet spot of, I would occasionally be mesmerized, oh, how does it work? How does his 360-degree view, or the fact that his neck doesn't turn, his eyes turn around, or how does he walk backwards and forwards, and it's the same for him, and all of that, that was interesting to watch, but it did not become, let's show what the computers can do nowadays. It was just well ensconced within the scene, within the urgency of IG-11 trying to get in there, Mandalorian trying to intervene, all of that. And indeed, Pete, IG-11 acts, I guess not even accidentally, he fires at the Mandalorian before the Mandalorian can then properly identify himself as a fellow bounty hunter. And they work out a sharing deal, although clearly IG-11 is very robotic in his ways. You know, you must say yes or no before I proceed, things of that sort.
I know that Taika Waititi, who voices IG-11, talked about his mentality, that he's this fearsome, dangerous robot, as we've seen. I mean, Matt, I've waited 39 years to watch an IG robot on screen just kick the type of butt that he did in this scene. But then you bring in both the dialogue element and the tone of a child, essentially, and the slapstick in the middle of this firefight.
Yeah, I think it's that sense to mix up the tonality enough so it's not kind of all nonstop space western. You have that little humor in there. You have the leaning into the sci-fi element, the weird element. All of it, I might add, Pete, in this very familiar setting of your classic, you know, Western movie hacienda with the well and, of course, the guards, now so many of them deceased. And they ultimately make their way to the porch area of the hacienda. Then they're trapped again. IG-11, this is the first time that he says he's ready to self-destruct, but No, the Mandalorian's going to hardwire the door, so, you know, put your self-destruct away. No use, they're still pinned, even with a cannon being wheeled out. I know it's floating, you know, but wheeled out, so to speak. Pete, maybe IG-11 should try and self-destruct himself again.
Yeah, there's a manufacturer's protocol that he can't be captured, which I really love. And we've never seen the middle of this IG droid open up, and there's a thermal detonator inside of it, which was a really cool detail. But he gives the Mandalorian cover. Once they're pinned by that cannon, the comedy ensues, and then we get the dart with the rope, turns it around, ultimately able to get rid of the captors here. They use charges to open the door to the encampment, and then the tracking fob to locate this pod with some detritus on top of it. It opens, there's a little bit of mist, and then the second we get that reverse shot, Matt, from the pod itself, looking at the Mandalorian, and down the very bottom you see the ears, it is impossible to not be enthused.
Now, Pete, let's make it very clear right now a couple of things. We'll pause the narrative to get a couple of things clear. First of all, correct me if I'm wrong, the species to which Yoda belongs has never been named on screen, off screen. I don't know about your legends stuff, but there's not an official name, right?
So it's a little bit of a touchy subject. Frequently, people will cite, oh, that species, they are called the Wills. It's never been formally determined that Yoda is a Will. That may come through this series, and if that's the case, great. It's never been canonically decided that's the case. I mean, they talk about the Guardians of the Wills in Rogue One, but we never ever know that Yoda's species, this being just the third being, green with those ears, not named Yoda, not named Yaddle, ever glimpsed in all these years of live action Star Wars.
So should one of us, probably me, slip and refer to the species as Yoda? I guess I want to get that out of the way and say, if that gets accidentally said, in no way am I, or I think you, Pete, saying that this is the baby Yoda. I mean, the chronology would be all wrong.
There are people that already believe it is baby Yoda. And again, the Empire has fallen. Yoda has given himself over to the Force. This 50-year-old baby, and IG-11 pointing out that species age differently. This one might live for centuries, kind of like Yoda did for 900 years he reached. Look as good, you will not.
So with all of that very, very clear, yeah, the big reveal. And also, Pete, circling on back to our mid-episode flashback, do you remember when Baby the Mandalorian, if that's who he was flashing back to, got placed into, you know, a well or a box or a hidey hole by Mom to be protected? Did anyone protect him? I don't know, but here we have a baby in the exact same situation. Interestingly, IG-11's orders were to terminate it. We know that the orders were very explicitly keep it alive, you know, much lesser prize if you bring it back dead or proof of death. But IG-11, totally ready to terminate it, gets shot in the head, reveal by the Mandalorian, saving the baby. Pete, dashing my hopes of an IG-11 Mandalorian team-up buddy comedy for the rest of these episodes. What? Well, record scratch, as some critics said, to end the episode.
Well, hang on, though. We'll return to that. We are talking about a droid, Matt. Oh, wait, we've fixed it. He's back up and running. But this last shot, this floating bassinet, the hand extended by the Mandalorian, the infant, 50-year-old infant hand extended from the bassinet, just the stuff of legends. And then I really appreciated the credit sequence with the art of what we had previously seen and then things throughout the episode.
Pete, do you remember how Jon Favreau seemed to be at the press thing in October? He seemed to not, when he was talking about, oh man, there's all this great concept art, where is a place that we could show it? And it was like, John, you're clearly teasing a book. Where else would you show it? Pete, they're showing it here. He was teasing the credits as this awesome viewing experience. You know, it's not your Marvel movie thing, but kind of in that ilk of stick around for the credits to see some great stuff.
Let's chase down some theories.
Well, Pete, first theory / question that comes to my mind is, how is it that the client has become involved in this search for the green-eared child? Maybe that's the best way to put it, the green child. And from where are these conflicting orders coming from? Kill it, no, save it, no, save it, and if you have to, kill it.
I wonder if that was the client doubling up there, to be honest. But that the scientist, Dr. Pershing, is looking to get a hold of this asset, clearly there's going to be some aspect of, all right, is this species endangered? We've seen so few of them. Are they going to go down the Force, road that all of the species that Yoda is a member have the Force? I mean, it's certainly a way to go down it. I'd almost prefer that they didn't, because it would feel a little too evocative of the movies. At the same time, we so identify Yoda with the Force. I almost feel like that species, you know, that would be a defining characteristic. I'm willing to let the show unfurl the story as they have planned, but, you know, that Dr. Pershing needs it alive, some kind of experimentation. I mean, my mind whirled to, we've seen the tease of Dark Rey potentially in The Rise of Skywalker. Is there some kind of bad Yoda species Force user potentially, you know, in their brains that they'd like to be able to do? Do they want to harvest organs or, you know, learn how it is, you know, so strong with the Force? I'm really, really interested to see where they can take it.
And let's talk for a minute about Dr. Pershing. I mean, you talk about character name and acting and costume design all coming together. He's on the screen for very, very little time, but there's just immediately this read of him as 1930s mad scientist or evil scientist or, frankly, kind of, you know, Nazi experimenter, that kind of thing. None of it is presented over the top, but it's just they've nailed the look so that it's not, you know, Dr. Pershing, the great therapist from Sopranos who's really out to help somebody. It's, no, this is not a doctor that you want to go see. This is like, how did he get that doctorate on what backwater crazy place?
It's amazing to think we have had 42 years of Star Wars, and this is the first character to ever wear space glasses. And he's a scientist, and he's wearing the same type of getup that Galen Erso, that Jin's father in Rogue One, had as an Imperial scientist. Yet we know the Empire has fallen. So these loyalists, however they might be functioning as what's left over of this remnant, attempting to, like the client says here, restore the natural order of things, which to fascists is they are in control and others are not.
And I think throughout this episode, we see spelled out not just kind of in the Western aesthetic, which I know I've mentioned multiple times, but the scope of the show. Yes, this is one of the most expensive series ever. Yes, depending on how you cut the cake or how series expenses were divided by episode, that sort of thing. Yes, this episode could be tied for some of the episodes of Game of Thrones as most expensive offering of TV, most expensive episode of TV ever. The flip side is, I know there were some complaints, you know, mostly critics, not to say most critics, but most of the complaints seem to come from the critical corner that, you know, oh, this isn't kind of big enough. This isn't Star Wars enough. And the show very clearly, going from planet to planet as an analog for town to town. Pete, you mentioned before all the stuff with the green-eared child. What will the, will it end up being Force connected? Even if it does, my bet would be that maybe the Dr. Pershing client story goes over there with those are their experiments. But Mandalorian says, well, back on the road I go at the end of the story arc, at the end of the season, whatever it might be. And yeah, there's the Force and stuff over there, but you know, it's John Wayne in Stagecoach. That civilization isn't meant for me. I'm headed down south.
The end game is so unclear, and I really deliciously approve of that at this point. You know, if we had the mustache twirling of, we will take the Force-sensitive green-eared child and use it to make clone green ear children that will be completely obedient to the Empire, I feel as if this is a diminished take. And, you know, what it could be, the number of different things it could be at this point outweigh what it might even end up being. But I just love the vagary at this point, as well as so many other details of this series. You know, these foundlings, that this underground Mandalorian community exists on this middle planet in the episode, that no signet has been revealed yet. There seems to be, you pointed out, the potential religious overtones of the armorer's foundry there, you know, that what's going to come of that, the reshaping, the forging of the Beskar steel, which, you know, we've got that Cam Tono still floating out there. You know, the pauldron metal was a down payment, and now there's no way he's turning this over to the Imperial remnant. So, like, what happens with the steel? Does he attempt to go after it? Does he need the steel to protect the infant? There's, you know, you're just whirling. Thank goodness, Matt, we have 3 days until we get a next episode.
I mean, it's funny, even going back and listening to some of our old podcasts, whether it was Mandalorian or otherwise, talking about, you know, what's the right, in the world of streaming, is it drop the entire season in one day so you can binge? Is it this? Is it that? And I think we've all come to the realization, hey, regardless of, even if you take your podcasting pals out of it, if you really want to savor a show and savor the discussion with other people who like it, that's not, you know, you can't binge it all in one day. You have to be able to make predictions or have thoughts or reflect or whatever it might be. So, okay, once a week. Here they're kind of splitting the baby. No baby harm, pun intended. But here it is, the fact that you get to mull over this. And, Pete, it's Tuesday night. Before you know it, boom, it's Friday morning. And we're all doing the exact same thing. Can I squeeze this in before I need to get to work? Maybe. Can I use the liberal download policies of Disney Plus to listen to it on the drive-in? Oh, I don't want to be too distracted, but maybe I will, maybe I won't. And we get that so soon before we settle into one a week, one a week, one a week for the rest of the run.
Yeah, and certainly can't wait. It's going to be a long wait that first Friday to Friday. Much prefer that this stinger that occurred at this end of the episode, we will return to it, pick up with Chapter 2 on Friday. The Carbonite, Matt, I feel as if they've retroactively changed the idea behind carbon freezing things. In The Empire Strikes Back, and I know a little bit about it, it is my favorite movie of all time. In The Empire Strikes Back, carbonite is used at the Bespin facility for Tabana gas, and it's only as a sideways thing. Oh, we will freeze Captain Solo. That will be a test. We really want to freeze Luke Skywalker to bring him to the Emperor. It was never a, yes, all bounty hunters carbon freeze their bounties. And, you know, through the years, it's become, well, it was done there, and now it's a thing. But that we've got the carbon freeze chamber mini portable travel edition on the Razor Crest, and you can do it in a way that you don't need to send your quarry into the hole and have the Ugnaughts flip the switch and whatever. But, you know, it's essentially like an alcove, and then you've got another wall hanging on your ship.
I, for one, bought it. I mean, I think of the Wright brothers. Nobody made a plane for the history of humanity before the Wright brothers. After the Wright brothers did, I mean, it's a handful of years later, like one or two or three, that other people are doing knockoffs, copies, worse copies, better copies, slightly better rudder, slightly worse wing frame, whatever it might be. And it just obviously proliferates from there to, you know, planes, plane war, bombers, jets, going to the moon, etc. And just so fast. If you're going to say this one technology, nobody ever kind of went down that road, and then all of a sudden, oh man, when you lower the intermix formula to this, and when you do that, hey, it worked for Captain Solo. I really can buy that, you know, what's the space of time between Empire and Return of the Jedi? I know in movie release, it was 3 years. What is it in the chronology?
I've seen 6 months. We've never been, again, formally told. It counts on screen. It doesn't count if it's in a book or something like that. And then you had the rearrangement with the Disney buy of, you know, legacy versus canon. You know, they call it legends. And then there's the real stuff. So there's some time in between. We can assume it's been 5, 6, 7, 8 years. I like what you're saying. And listen, I love the aspect. I mean, Matt, you've been to my home where I have a carbon frozen bust of Han Solo on my wall right across from a Mandalorian skull. So, you know, that I'm looking at right now. But I just wonder if maybe they got a little carried away with that. I do really like it, though.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say carried away. I would say clearly Star Wars is this animal where you need to have X number of touchstones, but you also need to have X number of things that are different. And I know that's true for lots of things, comic book stuff, James Bond, etc. But I feel like you need to have something like, oh man, now all bounty hunters do this. It makes visual sense, even if the science is a little sketchy, because Star Wars has never been as much about the science as opposed to, hey, we made a really cool ship out of, you know, B-17 bomber parts, and we turned it upside down and this and that the other. Now it's a weird flying ship in Return of the Jedi for approximately 3.8 seconds. Let's do YouTube videos about it. And I think there's just a little bit more flexibility there to be wacky, and how do you ground the wackiness? You make it a bit more familiar.
The Mandalorian has some beef with droids. He doesn't want the land speeder piloted by the droid. He definitely has a problem with IG-11, which gets settled at least as far as this episode is concerned. Still think we might see IG-11, given that Taika Waititi is directing an episode and Doughty just did this. I can definitely see a situation maybe where he gets rewired, redone, change of attitude, not so by the book, what have you. But what is the Mandalorian's deal with droids? Is it that they can track? Is it that, you know, they're recording? What's the hang up?
I would dare say, Pete, in this 8-episode, $125 million outing, I would accept it's just a character thing. He's just not into droids. Does that then open up his world to not having the magic R2-D2 who can unlock locks when you need to, or the magic C-3PO who can tell you what the other thing, creature, robot, etc. is saying? You know, could be a way to just make the road a bit more challenging for the character. And if that's the end-all and be-all, that's fine. I don't know that I need a prequel episode, a flashback episode, where we really understand that when Mandalorian was a boy, there was a three-quarter covered C-3PO who hurt him, or whatever it might be. To me, it's just, there's something so immediate about this show where it can just exist in the now, and you don't necessarily need tons of backstory, nor, frankly, I know there's more seasons coming, but I don't feel like, you know, oh man, the first season is done, now we're only starting to get to know him. I think it kind of is in this now.
I was really surprised we did not meet Gina Carano's Cara Dune in this episode.
I was too, and it's funny, Pete. I'm sure that if people were to listen to this podcast and then go back and listen to what was it, about three quarters through season one of Star Trek Discovery, when we had a 41-minute episode, which by the time you do similarly length credits and a much shorter title sequence, that episode was about the same length as this episode. And I don't know about you, Pete, I was foaming at the mouth. I pay good money. I pay per month. You're shorting me. This should be a 60-minute episode, not a 40-minute episode. All I can say, again, for this episode, I know she's coming. It would have been great to have her introduced here, but there's a real particular arc to this story. It ended up being a 40-minute story. Maybe they're all going to be 40 to 45 minutes. I don't know, but it just felt right. And now, of course, because we've seen the previews, we can look forward to her joining the cast.
No coming attraction preview for the next episode, nor the season. They're really, really playing this close to the vest. I gotta wonder too if the pilot and the second episode might even have been conceived since the drop is so close together as some kind of two-parter.
Well, I guess that's something to look forward to, particularly since we are in the theory segment here. You know, do we end episode 102 with more of a sense of, you know, and now the adventure truly begins, that sort of thing. All the parties have come together. That well could be. I also wonder, too, I don't know to what degree Favreau was writing towards the Disney Plus business model, which is to say, you know, it's streaming. You know, they're going to pick you up for the entire season so you can spread stuff out more. Okay, fine. That's lots of places now. Even, I think, in a network TV, they're much less... they're much less willing to cancel a show outright. But also, like, you know, to what degree is it like, hey, John, we're getting some really, or here's what we're going to do in a year. We're going to offer a 1 year and a 3 year and really loop people in. Oh, okay, cool. Now he really doesn't need to have something awesome in the first month to prevent people leaving after a month's time. It'll just be, no, cool. You're here for way longer than the run of The Mandalorian, so he can take whatever pacing he wants.
Right, extend that antenna.
Pete, let's hear what some people have been saying about this episode. Lots of tweets throughout the day from our pal at JJ Nato on Twitter. As of late morning, Pete, he had watched this episode 4 times. He took 5 hours off to sleep. He also said that he absolutely loves this Blade Runner-esque soundtrack for The Mandalorian. Pete, worth mentioning that the music is by Ludwig Göransson. He, of course, Pete, the Oscar winner for Black Panther, and he's also won a Grammy in the last year for his work with Childish Gambino.
Absolutely enamored of the score. Really sets the aesthetic. Interested to see how it's going to continue out throughout the season, what kind of themes we might get.
Pete, we also ran a Twitter poll, which we'll be doing after each episode. In fact, maybe I'll kind of aim for it, I don't know, early afternoon on, you know, for moving forward on Fridays. We'll leave it up there, obviously ahead of Star Wars Saturdays, so people can find it on the Twitter. But what did you think of the first episode? 1 star, Central Wire hit. Pete, that got 9%. That might just be grumpy people. I don't know. 2 stars, Round Door Cut, 0%. Pete, the zeros rounds. Maybe they were just afraid of being cut. 3 stars, I Have Spoken, got 18%. And 4 stars, 73%. Voting for 4 stars, A New Hope. And one response, Pete, from our great pal, Mary Kirk, that at Geek Kirk on Twitter. I am in love, and it's not really my fandom. They won me invert, and I want lots more like this.
Yeah, Mary had actually reached out on Facebook as well and said, the end of the first episode of The Mandalorian, obviously referring to the child. I had let Mary know months ago I knew the baby thing. She was kind of on the fence with Mandalorian. And like she indicated, it's not really her fandom. She comes from Star Trek, and, you know, there is not a bigger Marvel Cinematic Universe fan than Mary Kirk. Trust me, everybody else is just playing for second place. And I gave her the detail about the baby, and she's like, shucks, you got me. And I didn't know the identity of the baby, just knew there was a baby. I was kind of looking forward to it, kind of not, that they might do Ray, or the Raby, as I've referred to it with Matt off mic here. But I'm glad they went in the direction that they did.
And Pete, to think the time that you took 8-10 months ago going out to California, creating a fake pizza delivery company, showing up at various sound stages. Hey, I got your pepperoni pizza. All so that
Where's the chef, Favreau?
Hey, can you tell me about the bread rising? All so that you could glean some details. You got out knowing that there's a baby, but even your great Mission Impossible 1 lengths still kept from you the reveal of Greenier Baby. So, I mean, I know we've said it on mic. I know that we've definitely said it off mic. As big as this show is, it clearly was a closed door, closed off set that kept its secrets very, very well.
Yeah. And seeing paparazzi footage, no, I did not impersonate a pizza delivery man to get on the set. But you can understand how they've been able to keep so much of this out of, you know, prying eyes. And like I said, I just so excited for Friday, for the rest of the season, to get the rest of these stories.
Well, Pete, I know the Mandalorian mentioned that getting the $5,000 bounty that wouldn't even cover the cost of fuel. Our fuel, our costs for bandwidth and storage and other podcast expenses, helped out by the people, the generous people who support Fantastic Geek, by going to patreon.com/Fantastic Geek, and they truly keep this ship going.
Everybody who contributes gets access to exclusive podcast content, all sorts of tiers. So whether you're going to be in the Bounty Hunters Guild, whether you're going to be in the Fantastic Geek Guild, we're going to make it worth your while, get you a tracking fob, get you some calamari flan, get you whatever you need to help you do what you do as a fan and us do what we do as podcasters for our fantastic family of listeners.
So appreciated, especially as we mentioned at the top of the podcast, all this stuff ahead of us, going to do Watchmen tomorrow, Star Trek on Thursday, Mandalorian viewing on Friday, podcasting on Saturday, etc. So appreciated the people go to patreon.com/fantasticgeek. Pete, there is one goodie, though. It's a freebie. How can people talk to you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R-J, Ketelar, K-E-T-E-L. AAR 10,824 followers, can't be wrong.
And while I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, do be in touch with the podcast, comment on fantasticgeek.com. Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, where we are Fantastic Geek as well. But wait, Pete, there's more.
Facebook.com/Fantastic Geek with a PH, all one word, like it today.
We've covered all the non-Star Wars stuff we're going to be covering this week. If you are listening to us on the Mandalorian only feed, we will be back on Star Wars Saturday to talk episode 102 of The Mandalorian. Looking to get lots of great feedback with that little extra bit of time between 102, chapter 2, and our podcast of it. But for now, Pete, I will say adios to all the listeners and give you the final word.
I have spoken.